I want to thank tonight's sponsors. We have some great sponsors this evening. To Talia and Jeff Rosenblum for sponsoring in honor of their son's upcoming first birthday. May tonight's brachos and learning be a great sechus for him to be raised al derech hachinuch and to see a lot of nachas for him, 1 year at a time. Amen. 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 And also to Sari and Benji Bedziner, thank you very much for sponsoring also in honor of their family. See nachas and their children and have a lot of nachas till 120. I was prepping the shiur earlier tonight. It was kind of getting close to bedtime. And I was trying to like find a couple more things and work on it. And my kids really wanted my attention. And they were talking, Ava, Ava, Ava. I was like, one second. Ava, Ava. Like, give me a second. I was like, Ava, what? I was like, don't you see I'm working on parenting over here? Like, so I use that as a reminder that the caveat always has to be said, that I'm certainly no expert. The ideas that we're sharing tonight are more opportunities for us to learn together. But I will say that just earlier today, I graduated with my doctorate in child psychology. So that happened earlier today. So that I'm a little bit less unqualified, I'll put it that way. A little bit less unqualified.
I
wore a gown.
He's got the funny hat, you know?
I should have worn the gown, right?
You get the hat and the whole cape.
I had the cape called a hood. I was hooded. I was in Washington Heights. I was in the hood. Yeah, I was definitely.
All in cape.
Shabbos.
Yes.
Yeah?
I expect to see you in
speaking of the main show this week.
It's okay, I'll go
there.
It'll matter.
I'll be
there. We'll go.
You'll all come. It's a joint 9-10 main shul kiddush this week. Everyone expects to see.
Exactly.
Yeah. So that was really exciting. So I'm a little bit less unqualified than earlier today and maybe before. But still, these are things that we're all working on together. We're going to talk about discipline, mostly for kids. But the idea of understanding the challenges that come with discipline. We mentioned in our first year, talking about Revolbi, the wonderful Haredi educator who brought to the Haredi world something that was never thought of before, and that is that corporal punishment is not allowed. That is something that has changed in the world from when our parents were growing up, certainly in the times before that, certainly on a different continent. In Europe, that was definitely a very different approach. And things become accepted by communities based on science at different rates. Revolbi was certainly credited for bringing to the Haredi world the idea that discipline is not allowed, and we're going to read his essay, his thoughts on that matter tonight. That's one example he's going to have about thinking about the long game. That is the theme for tonight, thinking about the long game. Things that seem to work in the short term when it comes to chinuch, but then in the long game, thinking about the long term, it doesn't actually work out. Discipline is one example. And hopefully, if we have enough time, the second example he's going to talk about is about catering to the needs of each child. Sometimes parents put kids in a box. I guess that's discipline also, if you put the kid. Okay, fine. Sometimes parents try to box kids in with a certain proscribed, very, very formalized way of teaching, and that isn't really fit to the child's individual nature, which may in the moment kind of fill the parent's needs, but then in the long term doesn't actually work out well for the child. So we have a couple of essays, a couple of sections to read tonight, and again, I hope this is interactive. Share your own experiences, either being disciplined as a child, we can have therapy over here, or challenges. I hope this could be an interactive discussion where we could really delve into these very most important ideas. So the page starts out, page Tezayim. For those who are visual learners, we can make some time for reading it together inside. For those who are audio learners, or in John's case, eating learners, everyone could try to relate as best as we can. We'll make it accessible for all. So Revolbi writes, Hayestaklus L'tvach Aroch, we have to have an eye toward the long game, toward the long date. What does it mean to parent? What does it mean to educate children with an eye toward the long term? Rabbi writes, Chinuchu talich shetzarech liyos l'chadchila l'tvach aroch. Education needs to be a process that from the outset has an eye toward what's going to happen many years down the line. Kvar kasher hayeled ben shenasayim o shalosh shanim. Even when the kid is young, when the kid is just 2 or 3 years old, tzarech ladas ulekacha becheshbon, parent has to already consider shekisha hayeled ye ben arba esrei, chamesh esrei, hu ye betekufa kashem od. At the age of 2 or 3 years old, the parent has to already think the teenage years of this kid are going to be really challenging. I used to always say that my kids were 4 going on 14. They're such attitude. And I once told this to, we have twin girls who are 4. And I always said, 4 going on 14. And I spoke to a parent of actual teen girls, and she, so, she's like, I also thought when my kids were four, it was four going on 14. Then they turned 14, and 14 going on 14 is a lot worse than four going on 14. What seems like resistance, what seems like stubbornness, what seems like pettiness is really nothing compared to the teenage years. And for those with young children, first birthdays, and for young children to think about. He wants us to keep in mind, at the age of one, at the age of two, at the age of three, what is going to be with this child when they get to very difficult, very challenging years, the teenage years? Kedei la'avoras ha'tekufa shel gil arbas, Rebbe Shalom, to properly navigate the difficult teenage years peacefully. Hutzarech liyos kashur im ha'orim shelo b'yachas cham. There has to be a very strong bond, a very strong, solid relationship between parent and child to navigate those difficult years. And that bond is created very early in life. We have studies about attachment from the age of 6 months. It doesn't mean a child is definitely a goner by 6 months about how they're going to be at 14. But the things, the way that, in which we relate to our children at the age of 6 months, a year, 2 years, for sure, 3, 4, 5 years old, those are going to affect the kind of relationship we have with them and them toward us. And that's going to be critical for what actually happens during the tumultuous teenage years. Im ha'orim misyachasim b'tekifos el yeled ben shenasayim shalosh o arba. If a parent is very strict, very corporal, very intense with a kid of 2, 3, or 4, im mechanchem b'chinuch nukshe, they use very intense discipline methods. Turning to the next page, im makim oso, if they hit the child, b'dorshim mimenu ma'avar liyachotlo, and they demand things of the child that are unreasonable for the child to do, given the child's age and given the child's stage of development. That was the topic last time. The parent demands things that are beyond what a child can do and is harsh, not just with physical yelling, but not just with physical punishment, but yelling or threatening. And that can destroy the warm relationship between a child and parents. When the child is 2, when the child is 3, when the child is 4, it doesn't seem that these harsh discipline methods are destroying the relationship. At this early stage, it looks like things are working out pretty fine. You know why? At that age, the kid needs the parent for everything. My kids sometimes tell me, you're so mean, you're the worst parent ever. But I could tell that at this age still, they still like me. Right? Most of the time, they still like me. They laugh at my jokes still.
That's not going to last that much.
I know. So I got to take advantage of it. Right. I'm in a honeymoon phase for the shul and for my kids. So at this young age, the kid needs the parent for everything. The kid knows that he or she cannot do anything on their own. They have no money. They have no access to drive around or to get the places they want to go to their adventure lands and to have their own cupcakes for their birthday parties. They know they need the parents. So intense discipline does not manifest as a damaged relationship at that young age. Aval acharkach, but years down the line, kishahayela ben arbaasar, when the kid is a teenager, let's say 14, ba'im ha'orim muftaim v'tzoakim, parents come along and they're surprised, and they scream and cry, and the parent says, "Ain any mevin ma im hayelat shili? I don't know what's up with my kid. Hu lo medaber iti klal. My kid no longer talks to me. All our conversations are through the door. Hu lo misaper li shum davar. He refuses to answer my questions. How was your day? Right, when the kid's little, how was your day? Good. When they get older, how was your day? Or like, how was your day? Nothing. Ain li musag ma holech etzlo. I don't know what's happening with this kid. I don't know. 14 years old, and where is that bright, smiling, laughy, jovial kid I used to know? And now I don't understand what's happening. A flip of a switch. Kishahorim ba'im ishoalim oti malasav. Ravobi says that he's been consulted many a time by parents who want to know, what should I do? My kid is 14, and my kid has stopped talking to me, and is so moody and so disruptive. Ani shoaltam. So I respond to them, and I ask them, Emorli, tell me about the kid's youth. Hayakita et hayela kishahaya ben shalosh. How did you discipline the kid when he was 3? How did you raise her when she was 4? V'hu ona, the parent answers, Kamuvan, of course I hit my kid. Hare hayisi tzarech l'chanechasa. They proudly say, that's education. That's discipline. Of course I hit my kid when they were little and they weren't listening and they were fighting and they weren't sharing and they were raising their voice and they weren't eating nicely and they were coloring on the walls. Anything I'm forgetting?
Not going to sleep.
Of course, I screamed at them and threatened them and
yeah. Hair pinching.
See, that you do are things that your kids do. Of course I screamed at my kid. Of course I hit my kid. Of course I threatened my kid when they weren't listening. I'm the adult. It's my job to raise them right. I'm not going to have my kid make an embarrassment in shul. I'm not going to have my kid be inappropriate on the street and embarrass my family name and my family honor. Of course I discipline my kid by spanking or by threatening or by locking them in the closet. Those we don't do. but of course, anymore, right? Right? Basement, right. At least not in the last couple hours.
Right.
Ravobi says when the parent responds, of course I hit my kid when they were young. He says, Azay ani meshiv, then I say back to them, Achshav ata mishalem ba'ad hamakot shenatata lo az. Now you are reaping the rewards. Now you're facing the consequences. Parents love to call things consequences, as opposed to calling it punishment. They don't want to be like, I remember my niece, my first niece, when her father was yelling at her, because she was being really disruptive, and he kept saying, no. She's like, you're like King Paro. You're just, no. It was cute. He never hit her either, just for the record. The parent says, no, of course I disciplined my kid. And Ravobi says, now at the teenage years, you're paying for what you did when the kid was young. Hamakot. V'hayachas hanuksha, the physical blows or the screaming or the threatening, and the difficult relationship. Mifafa'im b'teit ha'akara shel hayeled mibli sheyodea. There's an unconscious effect that it has on the child's awareness and on the way the child relates to the parents, to the child's self, to the world. Hadvarim nistarim b'toch nafsho. The child internalizes a sense of being a bad kid. My parents can't be understanding. I'm not good. I can't get along. My parents say, what is wrong with you? And for me, it's so challenging that the child doesn't know what to do. Ubizman hit bagrut. Hadavar yotzei umetgaleh. Something is growing. We use the mashal of building and planting, of planting. Something that was wrong in the planting stage may manifest itself many years down the line. And the parents come and they say, how do I fix this right now? Well, maybe the manifestation, what you're seeing now, is just a revelation of what was actually going on 10, 12 years ago during the planting stage. The Haurim Ro'im She'ibdu Es Hayachas El Hayelet. And the parents realize at this point that they have destroyed, harsh language, they have destroyed the relationship with their child. Bishvilam Zetzar Gadol. At this point, the parent is experiencing immense distress at the fact that their child won't talk to them, that their child doesn't trust them, that their child doesn't want anything to do with them. But the trauma, the actual damage, is the one to the kid who grew up in a home that was abusive. And even if it's not formal abuse, but intense, the child suffered very, very serious blows to their self-esteem, physically, emotionally, socially. They experienced something harsh from their parents, their attachment figures, who they're supposed to have a sense of trust, who they're supposed to see as a source of unconditional love. And sometimes parents try to soften the blow by when they punish the kid, saying, it's because I love you, and I'm doing it for you. I heard on a podcast from Elisheva Liss, who is an expert in family therapy, and couples therapy, and sex therapy, and she said she dealt with a couple who had a really hard time. The woman had a really hard time with intimacy, and really had a hard time with the idea of love, because whenever she heard the word love, she thought of being punished. Every time she was sent to her room, her father would say, it's because I love you, slam. And for her, growing up, in this case, it wasn't teenager, it was probably teenager also, but beyond, it had an effect on her ability to form healthy relationships in intimate ways. Because the idea of love, the idea of close, if that's what love means, then what is the child internalized about their ability to trust? If love means someone can have power over you, or someone can scare you or threaten you, then maybe I don't want anything to do with love. We have to have the long game in mind. When the kid is young, when the kid is in our control, when the kid is able to be bossed around and the kid is able to be stuffed in the closet, then we have to think about what are these effects going to be in the long term. Ha'orim tzrichim livnot yachas cham el hayelah. The parents have to think about ways to build a warm relationship. Kach shekasher yeh hayelah b'tekufas habagar. So when the child does reach the teenage or the developed adult years, shehi tekufa kasheh, which is going to be hard regardless. The kid is developing a sense of autonomy, a sense of self. They're going to push boundaries. They're not four going on 14. They're actually 14. And there's a certain sense of rebellion or a certain sense of pushing back that's going to need a strong relationship. A lot of my mentors have taught me to use language about emotional currency. You have to have strong emotional currency. This is true for children. This is true in spousal relationships and in business relationships. You have to have strong emotional currency because sometimes there are going to be times we get upset and have a hard time. And we have to make withdrawals from our emotional currency. If we have a lot of money in the bank because we built up strong, warm moments and good bonding moments and special one-on-one time with them, and the emotional bank is high, then there's a lot to withdraw from. We save for a rainy day. During the difficult teenage years, those are the rainy days. Those are the very challenging years. There's a lot of emotional bank there, then we can withdraw. And yeah, there's a lot to build on. There's a lot to use during those difficult years to navigate the difficult time of adolescence. But if the bank is empty because there's no strong relationship there, or we're in the red, we're already in debt because we've already harmed the child in so many ways, well then when the difficult time comes along and we need to make a withdrawal, you're already in the red. There's already so much damage there. How are we supposed to navigate that difficult time, which is inevitable? The difficult period of adolescence is inevitable. The only question is, are we going to have a strong foundation of trust and actual love as opposed to telling the kid you love them when you punish them? Are we going to have that strong emotional bank to withdraw from, or are we going to be in the red? The strong, warm relationship will be able to withstand and help during those difficult years. What do you think about this?
Does he give advice at any point for the people, or does he just say, go build a time machine and come back?
Right. If they're already, it sounds like very dismissive at that point, like, sorry, I can't help you, you really messed it up. He doesn't specifically address that, and in some ways he might say, it can't be fixed all the way. I saw that someone sent me this screenshot of a tweet of someone talking about their experience in therapy. Someone we don't know, just a person on Twitter, who said, I was doing a Zoom therapy with my therapist, and my mom happened to walk in by accident, and the patient said, I wanted to say to my therapist, meet the star of the show! Right? So in every time, parents damage kids in every single way. My favorite cartoon is still the one where a parent is holding a little infant, and the mother says to the baby, one day you're going to grow up to tell your therapist what a great mother I was. Yes, you will. Yes, you will. So there's always, Freud certainly had a lot to say about mothers and their effects. And maybe it is irreparable in some sense. Or maybe there's some damage parents do all the time. He would say to minimize that damage from the early years. Now, I think the idea of the emotional bank is really helpful because that means that even if it's 14 and it seems like it's too late, and these are the people who are coming to him with this problem, there is still room to say, can we build some more bank now? Can we find ways to build that now? Instead of forcing the kid to listen, fighting against the rebellions, and going to shul, not going to shul, making brachos, not going to brachos. It's hard at that point to try to draw back on an emotional bank when there is none in the account.
It almost sounds like the child is being punished for nothing. Like I thought Hashem doesn't really punish the children on the sins of the father. Like maybe like to punish the father, like he would do something to the child, but like if the child is just growing up and the outcome of what the parents are doing, which a child can't really control when they're two or three, and then they get damaged from it, that doesn't really sound like something that I thought Hashem would typically do.
It's a challenging thing to think about childhood trauma, right? How could it be that children who did nothing wrong, whether it's from a family member in the education process, or it's, God forbid, those who have been harmed in other ways by strangers or people that the family trusts. So then I guess that question is a strong question, right? For children who are harmed in traumatic ways, why is that fair to the child? I guess we also can ask children who are unfortunately born with disabilities or defects. I guess that's a tough question to answer. I guess one of these, tzaddik v'ra'lo, no one is more pure and innocent than a child. So how come there are children who did nothing wrong and yet bear the burdens of trauma and bear the mistakes of those who raised them? I think that's a strong question that we're not going to be able to answer, to be able to say this is why it happens or this is how the universe is fair. But yeah, I think there's an unfortunate reality that children who did nothing wrong still grew up with difficulties with trust, difficulties with social skills, difficulties with emotion regulation. I think that's not the kid's fault, and at the same time, the kid is the one who has to deal with it. One of my favorite modalities of therapy is called DBT, Dialectical Behavior Therapy. Dialectical behavior therapy was developed for those who struggle with black and white thinking and for those who have a hard time regulating their emotions. And one of the foundations of DBT is a dialectic, which means two opposite things that sound opposite but actually can both coexist. And one of them is people did not cause their own problems. To a large extent, children or adults, we did not cause our own problems. The socioeconomic situation we grew up in is largely not our fault. The generation we were born into, any abuse, God forbid, a person experience, any traumas, that's not a person's fault. That's one half of the dialectic. Most people are not responsible for the problems that they're facing. And people are still responsible to solve their own problems. At the end of the day, who's going to solve the problem for us? How are we going to overcome these challenges? What can I do now? And maybe it's not too late. Maybe it's too late in the parenting sense of, okay, how many lollipops can I give the kid now to go to shul? The kid's 14. That's not going to work anymore. It's too late for that. But is there still room for a better emotional building now? What can the parents do now? I don't think he would say that they're lost forever, but they were still not capitalizing on the foundational years, and that can't be brought back.
I mean, but he doesn't really speak of the concept of therapy, mental health, right? I feel like that's a foreign concept.
That's where I come in.
Yeah. But I mean, for someone who is damaged, the parent and the 15-year-old goes to therapy, really expresses themselves, owns, where they, went wrong. I mean, that's one practical way of sort of bridging that damage.
It's true. I believe it, and it's clear from the way he's writing that he's speaking to parents of very young kids. That the message of this particular essay is trying to gear itself toward those with younger kids, saying, if you're working with really young kids, have the long game in mind. Because if you don't, you're going to be surprised and upset later. I believe if he was talking to people who are dealing with struggles of a 14-year-old, I don't think he would stop with what he wrote before about, well, you messed it up when the kid was 3, good luck to you. I'll use your story for my share next week. I don't think that's what he would say to them only. Right. It's clear from this essay that he's speaking to parents of very young children, saying, take my word for it, those things can't be fixed in the way that they can be addressed now. And therefore, keep this in mind. As you're parenting a very young child, realize the things that look like they're working now are not really going to work in the long term. Now, I think if he was speaking already to those who were damaged, I think he would agree that counseling or therapy or reparative ways of dealing with relationships and trust, these things can be fixed. There are ways to help people overcome trauma. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a profession. I wouldn't have a way to get all those loans off my back, right? So that there's something to be done. But his focus is on, hey, while the kid is young, keep this in mind. But if he was writing an essay for those working with teenagers, I'm sure he would talk about ways to restore it, ways to build some bank now, though it's never going to be exactly the same. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? This is a big stuff, heavy stuff. In this last paragraph on this topic, he wraps it up very, very strongly. He writes on page Yud Zayin, L'famim nitmeh shemagiyim l'totzaot yoter tovot b'amtzaot hanokshot. Sometimes it looks like a parent is accomplishing great things with very intense, harsh means. Aval hachacham eina b'rosho. Because I'll have an expression that a wise person has an eye toward the future. V'horim shiodim es sod hachinuch, and parents who are in touch with this foundational secret, foundational core value of education, and the critical importance of having an eye toward what's going to be in 10 years down the line, nizharim ma'od begil harach, to be very cautious during the child's young formative years, not just to look at what seems to be working immediately. It happens many times where the parent is frustrated that the kid is not obeying, the kid is not listening, the kid is not following instructions. And the parent says, I give my kid many smacks across the face, and look what happens now. Now the kid listens, it seems to be working. And the parent praises themselves, and they brag, and they say, ah, that's Hebrew for ah, A-H, Aleph Hey, ah, ah. Look at my great chinuch tactics. Look, I can get the kid to be quiet. I can get the kid to sit down. I can get the kids to behave. All it took is a smack and it works, and that's reinforced. The parents get what's called negative reinforcement, that the stress of the disobeying child is reinforced, the hitting is reinforced because it seems to get the results that they want. And the parent is so proud. Yes, I'm an excellent disciplinarian. Aval zoi simcha mukdemes me'od, this is very premature joy. Ba'ad ha-hanhaga ha-zo, in the midst of this behavior, of this approach to chinuch, asidim l'shalem kasher hayelad yiyah ben arbas rei ben chamesh esrei. Now it looks like it's working. And that's why it's so challenging. It looks like it's working. Ba'ziya kasher me'od sakenas hamuvas. And then, to Jeff's point from before, it's not impossible, but it's hard. It's a different avoda. It's a different different challenge. How is a parent going to go about this? How is a parent going to rectify things that don't seem to be working? I want to share with you some of the findings when it comes to punishment in our literature and why it seems that punishment is not as effective as other things that can be done. I want to make this as practical as possible. I'd love to hear if we have other ideas, please definitely share them. We'll make a think tank together to think of ways why punishment is challenging and what ways we can do things that are very difficult. So one reason our studies show why punishment is not effective, again, in the short term it looks like it's working, but punishment is often very hypocritical. And very often it models for the kid the wrong lesson. Right? The kid is fighting with their sibling. And they're pinching and they're scratching and they're grabbing and they're screaming and they're yelling. And the parent says, "Stop fighting, give me that!" And they grab the toy away. Okay, you're telling the kid don't grab. But to assert yourself and get him to stop grabbing, you grabbed. I know this gets into me sometimes. Like everyone's like talking at the same time, like one at a time, like, "Will you stop yelling? Just stop yelling." Okay, I'm saying one thing, but I'm modeling something different. What are we telling our kids? Now, when you get angry, you're not allowed to hit. But if you're really angry and you're bigger and stronger, then it's okay. No, we don't scream. No, we don't grab. But if you're taller and you're older and you have a beard, then it's okay. So what does the kid walk away with? Okay, for the younger sibling, I am bigger, I am stronger, so then I can grab, I can't. We're saying one thing, but we're modeling exactly the opposite. The punishments themselves are hypocritical. The punishments themselves are modeling the things that we're telling the children not to do. So in the short term, it's working because we are bigger, we are stronger, we do have the keys to the, I want to say house, but we have the keys to the closet. Right? We have the opportunity to lock them in. Which again, we've never done before. But
they lock us out, though.
They have, right, I don't know where that came from. But they've locked us out before.
They do.
They've locked us out before.
Maybe we should be bringing them to this.
Right. Oh, they're awake right now. They're awake. No. But we're saying one thing, but we're modeling exactly the opposite. And sometimes you don't realize how much they're internalizing until they say it back to you. Sometimes they say the things like, "Where do you get that from?" And then, it's not a hoover, it's me. I'm like, it's this. What did one of them say the other day? "How about you're being extremely difficult?" Where did she get that from? What were some of their threats recently? "Ah, but you're not listening, you're not giving me the cookies I want, I'm going to send you to the neighbor's house." I've never said that to them, right? "But I'm going to send you to Akira's house across the street.
I'm going to put you in jail.
I'm going to put you in jail."
That's the jail, by the way.
Behind us. "I'm going to put you in jail." One time she said, I'm taking away your titsis." It sounds so ridiculous because there's no correlation to the cookie she wants and my titsis. Like, joke's on you, I'm sweaty anyway. Like, I don't want to run this anyway. But we laugh at their examples of punishment because there's no correlation between what they're asking for and how they're threatening us. But then we have to stop and ask, do our punishments have correlation to what it is we're trying to tell them? The biggest problem in the research why punishment doesn't work is because it doesn't teach the child anything. They're getting some sense. The parent is red in the face. The parent is stomping their feet. The parent is screaming and threatening, and they're hitting or confiscating electronics. The parent is clearly indicating they're not happy with the current way the kid is talking or walking or behaving or sharing or lack thereof, or that the parent is unhappy. But the kid doesn't know what to do. You're not telling the kid what to do. You're telling the kid what not to do. So what's the kid supposed to do? You're giving a lot of attention to the negative behavior without specifically telling the kid what to do. They realize that this earns a smack or a spank or a scream or a yell or a threaten or a confiscation of a privilege of screen time. They're getting that something is wrong, but they're not being told what to do. The consequences not only don't correlate to what they're doing, but they're not really being explained why something is wrong. Thus, it's obvious why coming out of bed is wrong, because it bothers us. But does the kid understand that? It's obvious to us why the kid's not making a bracha. Take the food out of your mouth. Does the kid understand the difference? Do they understand? Well, why would the kid care about that? Kid is young, so what are we expecting from them? So we can threaten and we can scream, "You can't get this until you make..." But do we take the time to explain why it's important to stay in bed? Why it's important to share? We got as far with our kids as, why is it important to not hit your sister? Because then she cries. And why is that bad? It's annoying. Okay. Okay, we're getting somewhere. But do we have these conversations with our kids? Or do we assume that they know? Get off the table in shul. This is a personal example. Get off the table in shul. Why? Can you? It's fun. The stage is also off limits. Can they go on the stage? No, they're not going to go on the stage. Or they can't go on the table, not the table. Why is the table worse than the stage? They're getting the idea that the table is worse than the stage. But to be explained why, if they can fall off the table, they can get pushed off the stage, fine. But to some extent, the stage is a safer place to climb onto, and a table is not. The tables are very flimsy. No offense to the 9-10 tables, but those tables are not going to support two of them. You know, I said no offense. I said no offense.
And getting out the concept of like, they don't need to know why, they just need to listen to their parents and
their
respect.
Do as I say, not
yeah.
do as I do.
Do as I say, not as
yeah.
I do.
I understand what you're saying about the hypocritical part, but right. doesn't there have to be this essence of like, we are the parent, you listen to what we say.
It's a hoax.
It's a hoax. Take this red cow and just bring it to your room. No, it's a really good question, right? If a kid has to have an answer for everything and the kid has to agree, then I think there's a middle path between draconian punishment and explaining every little thing and getting the kid's approval before we can set a boundary. I think there's a middle path where we can explain to the kid, I already explained to you, but what? I already explained to you that it hurts your sister. I already explained to you that it's not safe. I already explained to you that we've been up all day and now Abba and Mama have to do some work. I've already explained to you that it's not safe to run in the street. I've already explained to you, and to say, I've already explained to you. And the kid might say, but I don't care about that stuff, okay? But at least you've explained to them. And maybe down the line, they'll be able to understand it more. Maybe down the line, they'll be able to, okay, my parent always told me not to do this, and it made sense in retrospect. I think there's a middle path between draconian, never explaining anything and being harsh and just being arbitrary and whimsical in our punishments, and being overly permissive and waiting for them to give us the green light before they can do anything. I think there's room to explain, and if they're not willing to agree, and the answer is, I've already explained to you several times why this is not safe and why this is not a good idea. And here's the next part. Can we give them replacement behaviors? Can we explain to the kid, A, the consequence and how it relates? Taking away your iPad. I'm taking away your iPad because it's interfering with your sleep. Taking away your iPad because it's interfering with your studies. There's a natural consequence. It's not, I'm taking away your tits so you give me a cookie. It doesn't correlate. It doesn't make sense to us. But if we can explain why we're taking away the iPad, and if we can explain to them how they can get it back, what they should be doing. And here's the thing, a very important missing piece. We don't always explain to the kids what they are supposed to be doing. And we give kids ways of knowing what's wrong, and punishment is clear what they're not supposed to be doing, but do we set up for them an opportunity to know what they are supposed to be doing?
So when you're in terms of like the punishments, right? So like you said, you know, you have to correlate the punishment with what they did, and, you know, or taking away your iPad because it's affecting your sleep. And I've totally done that, right? That exact same situation. But I understand that the iPad is affecting your sleep. And I can say to them, you know, this is why I'm doing it, because of this. But even my 12-year-old is going to be like, no, it doesn't.
I sleep better with it. I sleep better with this.
Yeah, right, exactly. So like even when we know we're right, and even when we can back up that we're right with sound scientific reasoning, the kids can trump us every time with the master formula of nah-uh. so like, how do you reconcile? Like, sometimes being right is not enough, which comes back to sometimes it's the equivalent of I told you so.
And that's where I think the middle path is. Meaning, I think we can fall to prey of just like taking it away and assuming that they understand. And as they get older, there's more, and I think this is where, based on last time's topic about adjusting to the developmental age of the child, the because I said so to a 3-year-old has to be different than the because I said so to the 12-year-old. For the 3-year-old, it could be just, I explained it to you, I'm not going to explain it again, it's bad for you, and for this reason it's bad for you. To the 12-year-old, he or she might be able to understand and not watch a video at nighttime, which gives the wrong message, but during the daytime, here's a video about explains how sleep cycle work. Here's a kid-friendly video about, you know, blue light and the ways in which it disrupts our circadian rhythm. There's a kid way to explain this too. Right? You'll bore them to sleep and then they'll be sleeping. And then that'll be the end of the problem. But I think it's important when we explain it to a 3-year-old, explain it to a 12-year-old, explain it to an 18-year-old, for each one at their level, there's a version of what we explain and a version of how we say, okay, at the end of the day, I make the rules. And I think combining these two things together, can we give, if we're going to discipline and put our foot down, then eventually it's going to come down to, okay, at the end of the day, I know better. You're going to have to trust me on this one. But that should not be the same level of not explaining for a 3-year-old to the level of not explaining to a 12-year-old. There's more we can say. We can bring in more evidence, a book that they can read, a kid-friendly book about some of these things. And there are very beautiful illustrated and good videos also to help kids understand some of these concepts about mental health, about sleep health, about eating, about sleep hygiene, and about proper eating and about proper discipline and emotional regulation. I hope that addresses your question. That there's, it's not yes or no. It's a question of, are we really explaining at this person's level, not too high and not too low? Are we giving them a proper wealth of understanding where it comes from? And at the end, the will always trump it, but at least we've tried, and at least we've given them something that they can look back later and say, you know, my parent took this away and always explained this to me. Deep down, I knew what they were talking about. I didn't really care about it at the age of 12, but now that I'm 18, I have better sleep hygiene because I know what my parents said. And now that I'm in college, and now that I'm studying, and I'm responsible for my own sleep cycle, I know what they told me. Right. So I think it's a matter of balancing those two things.
With that being said, can't you just say that going back to the kid being 14 and being damaged from however you treated them when they were 3, can't you be vulnerable with them as a parent and explain to them why you did the things you did when they were 3? And the way you behave and be vulnerable with your child and explain where you're coming from and hope that they understand at the age of 14 because they're at a new level of understanding things?
It's possible. I think as a concept, it definitely makes sense. I think if the kid isn't talking to the parent, I doubt they're going to want a lot, right. Right, through the door, the cans on either side of the door. No, but you're absolutely right. It's something very important to think about can we give a kid some context? He's speaking more about hitting a kid. And a parent could explain, this is why I hit you when you were young. Yeah. So to some extent, he's saying that that's never going to be something we can explain to a kid in a satisfactory way. You've made me feel unsafe. So a parent could explain the rationale. At the end of the day, the kid doesn't feel safe, doesn't feel they have autonomy over their body. So I think the answer to your question is, yeah, to some extent, there's room to build more emotional bank. There's room to accumulate more by having a conversation and apologizing. And the most vulnerable thing a parent can do is to apologize and say, you know, I didn't know better, or this is how I was raised. And I think that does matter to a kid. And that is part of a trauma therapy does sometimes include having a restorative session with the parent for the kid to have a chance to explain their anger. And as long as the parent isn't defensive when the kid is expressing, then there's a chance that the kid may not be as dismissive or rejecting when the parent is explaining. The parent says, I want to have a really open heart-to-heart and make sure to talk about these things, but your perspective is stupid. Let me tell you what I was thinking. So then there's no mutual respect. If the parent can really sit there and listen and say back, you know, in retrospect, maybe I was too harsh. In retrospect, I do see the way that damaged you, and maybe I can't fix those years, but what ways can we have more trust now? What ways can I show you trust? And if the parent takes that step to show the child, I understand you and I'm willing to own up to the things I'm not proud of, then I think that opens the door the other way as well.
In regards to 2 and 3-year-olds, because it is Borrella PR and draconian measures that you're talking about, it's very, at least in my mind, it's very hard to explain to a 2 and 3-year-old in certain situations where they put themselves in danger, running into a street, into a busy street, pulling them back, and explaining to them, sitting them down and say, hey, you really, at a 2 and 3-year-old level, you really can't go into that tree because it's going to hurt you. A car could go and not see you and run you over, versus, and I have done this where my kid has run through the street, I've taken a hand, I smacked it, and I told them, you can't do that, it's going to hurt yourself. And they, I think, learn that daddy's, I don't know about angry, but like I will get a potch and I will hurt more. I'll get hurt when daddy smacking my hand, and that's going to hurt, so I don't want to run into the street, versus the concept of, oh, I can't run into the street because I'm going to get hurt.
Worked for Pavlov.
That's an extra.
So how do you work through that?
It's a couple of really, really important things that you mentioned. There's a couple of important things that you mentioned, and one is that, and I've seen this before, where a parent is very, very in control, and the way that Chazal is an expression, the parent is pretending to be angry in order to teach a child a lesson that this is not right. The problem comes when a parent responds the same way to every single violation, exactly the same way. Yeah. If coloring on the wall, as frustrating in that moment, it's like, rip the crayon in half, right? In that moment, we're so angry. If the response to coloring on the wall is the same than crossing the street, then we're doing something wrong.
Yes.
If the response to coming out of bed at night for the 17 millionth time is the same as coloring on the wall and running in the street, if the response to snatching a toy or making a mess on the floor or not toileting properly is the same as running in the street, then the kid doesn't really understand. If a parent really can be fully in control, and the kid says, my parent only gets this angry and this worried when I go on the street, I think there is a Pavlovian conditioning that can happen there, where the child really gets, I don't get why it's bad in of itself, but this really worries my parent. That classical conditioning is lost when the parent is equally angry for very many other things too. Then the kid says, this is how daddy responds when I call her on the wall, when I spill something on the floor, when I'm late getting in the car, when I'm insisting on picking up extra sticks off the floor. I don't know why they do that. But if a parent gets equally angry for everything, so then if you're angry for everything, then the kid doesn't register it as that classical conditioning. So I think it's important to pick and choose. If there's going to be a very strong response, it has to be only for the kind of thing that the kid should get. Okay, this is really serious. But that raises the question of, then everything else is not serious, and how are you supposed to be frustrated about that?
I have it where, in my house, and I have a pool, so, they know they're not allowed to go into the pool area without a parent, and it's a hard set of rule, and if they do so, then there are consequences up to, being hit. There is life and death there. I don't care if they go out to the backyard and play on the swing set. And they want to do that on their own, have fun.
I think there's a lot to say, and very very often kids can't tell the difference between frustration and anger, or worry, or concern. And if we don't make that distinction clear to them, so then they interpret it all the same. Abba's always angry, mommy's always, worried, and it's not clear to them, that distinction. And the last thing I'll say, and we'll wrap up with this, is the missing piece is always not just to tell the kid what not to do, but to specifically give them things that they can do instead. Like, you can run here. I'm supposed to just say you can't run in the street. This is where running could be. You can climb here, but you can't climb there. You can't color on the walls, but you can color on these papers I give you, and you can choose any of the following 16 different colors, even though you always use the same one. But you can pick from these different colors, or you can use these markers here, or you can choose crayons over here. And very often, we think that by screaming, don't run, we're getting the kid to stop. But the reality is, from the kid's brain perspective, you're just giving running a lot of attention. You use the word don't, but they hear something about running gets to my parents' attention. There's a difference between don't run and walk, please. Don't color on the wall versus it's wrong because it damages the house. So we're giving them some kind of reason. Whether they're getting it or not is not always the most important part. Because at the end of the day, especially when they're young, this was your question, when they're 2 or 3, at the end of the day, they're not really going to understand. But it will matter, looking back, when they're 8 or 9, if they have a reason to hold on to. It will be at the age of 2 or 3 because I said so, but give them something that, looking back, will make sense to them, and also give them something that can be reinforced. This is the right way to say. Instead of, stop screaming, it's, can you tell me in this kind of a voice? And show them what this kind of a voice is. Well, when we're angry, we don't hit. We can push a wall. When we're frustrated, pushing a wall is a good one. We can wash our face. We can take a deep breath. We can count to 10. Right? Give the kid ways to express it. It's okay to be angry. It's not okay to hit. But it is okay to do these things. Here are some things you can do when you're sad. Here are things to do when you're upset. And give them a list. To have behavior charts where we reinforce and focus on the positive. Sometimes it's only because the kid has a negative behavior that we then start to focus on the positive and say, we're making a behavior chart. When I was at my first clinical placement, I was working in YCQ. I was working with a lot of second grade kids. And one kid, February, toward the end, the middle of the year, was a really great kid the whole year. And the teacher said, I don't know what's up with this kid. They're misbehaving and causing fights and not listening. And I spoke to the kid, and he said, well, Yehuda has a sticker chart. And Sammy has a sticker chart. And I figured if I act like that, I can get a sticker chart too. So if we only bring in the reinforcements, we only bring in the rewards, we only highlight the good behaviors when, oops, bad things are going, we can be proactive. We can already begin to, when nothing is wrong, to highlight, oh, I like the way you asked for that. I love the voice that you're using when you express that. I love the way you were able to work that out on your own, to find a way to do that. To give the child not just what not to do, but to teach them what to do. And if you're going to be draconian, you're going to be not explaining it, that's going to have an effect on their ability to understand and their resentment. And that's going to damage them. I think it's wonderful that we focused this whole time on this. I was, half of me was hoping that we would spend the whole time on discipline. We'll save this other topic for another time. But really, I'd like to wrap it up and really, I think, review some of the things that we talked about tonight. The damage that Rivolbi pointed out for parents in the long term. And he's speaking specifically to parents of younger children, to have in mind what are the long-term effects, what are the damages that can be done when we don't show a kid safety, when we don't show a kid trust, when we don't show a kid understanding, we don't show a kid that we're willing to listen to them. I think an important point we haven't mentioned tonight is that listen to the kid, as angry as they are at three, so give them a moment to sit down with them and listen to them. Not listening, I make this mistake all the time. We don't yell, we don't interrupt, we don't talk over people. We're not willing to listen to them. What if we can show the kid, okay, I'll give your 2-year-old version, I'll give your 3-year-old, 4-year-old version a chance to speak. And then I'll explain to you, oh, I understand you're so angry. You're so angry. Oh, I understand why you wanted to just hit or grab or push or scream. We don't want to hurt people because it's annoying. Fine. We don't want to hurt people. Here are some things you can do instead. You can tell me. But if they're going to come tell us, we have to be attentive the first time. If we're not going to be attentive when they call us and then they hit them, we say, oh, why didn't you come? I was coming. If we're not going to reinforce the behaviors of reaching out to us when they're having a problem, we have to go running. We can't tell the kid, reach out, call me if you need me. Tell Alba or Mama if you need me. But then when they call us, we don't come. I'll be there in a second. And they're like wrestling with each other. And like, oh, why didn't you call me? Well, they did. And then you didn't come running. So reinforce those behaviors ahead of time. Don't wait until the kid needs a sticker chart because nothing has been reinforced until now. Reinforce the behaviors, the way that they speak, how they resolve conflict, how they manage their emotions, how they're able to express themselves, how they're able to get the things that they want in a way. And to show them replacement behaviors. Okay, you can get this back when you go to bed. I'm taking this away. Right now it's distracting you from staying in bed. But when you go back in bed, tell them how they can earn it back. And the last thing I'll say is that a reward that's earned never should be taken away. A child works hard on a sticker chart, and they've earned something because of how they talk, or how they dive in, or how they speak, or whatever that is, and the kid does something awful the next day, you can't take away stickers, because that shows that the act is not valuable in and of itself. It could be lost. Now, every time you did this, you've earned the sticker, and when you finish the row, you get the prize that we promised you. And they could burn down the house the next day. I hope they don't. But they can't lose what they've earned. If they've earned it, it's only valuable if it's guaranteed. They've earned this reward. Any reward promised, anything earned, cannot be taken away from the kid, or else they learn that it's fickle and it's not guaranteed. Mitzvah Hashem, if you take these ideas in mind, for kids of all ages, to think about these things, to think about this in the long game, to think about the effects that we're having on their emotional development, on the trust, and most importantly, to find ways to listen to them, to find ways, and I'm speaking to myself more than anyone else here, doctorate or not, this is what I need to work on myself. To listen to them, to help them feel heard, even if we're at the end of the day going to explain to them why, as the parent, we know better, but to let the kid feel they have a chance to explain why it's fun to do this, or why it's exciting, and to say, I know it's exciting, I know it's frustrating, I know it's overwhelming, and to give the kids the language to be able to understand that, and then to say, and here are some other things you can do instead. You can push this wall, you can say this, you can go here, you can color here, you can climb here, you can do all these things. So, Mitzvah Hashem, if we keep this in mind, we should always be zochet to see great nachas from all of our kids until 120.
Amen. Amen.
Yeah, thank you.